You are listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit us at lfla.org.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Aloud. I'm Jessica Strand, the Director of Public Programming at the Library Foundation of the Los Angeles, or LFA. It's instrumental in supporting many programs at the Los Angeles Public Library, from homework help to college prep to early literacy. The list is long, and the programs are vital in giving access and support to Angelenos across this expansive city. We focused on resilience, and we picked this idea for many reasons. Most importantly, it spoke to how all of us had to be resilient in order to survive the last 2 years. We've looked at resilience from many angles, using fiction and nonfiction to focus on issues, people, and communities. During this time, we collaborated with KPCC, LAist, and the Los Angeles Public Library, and asked author and scholar Josh Kuhn to curate a series looking at LA's history by utilizing archival materials from the Los Angeles Public Library, a photograph, a sheet of music, and a menu inspired musical interpretations and conversations about the Honduran community, the influence of LA gospel, and through the eyes of a path-breaking queer mariachi group, a discussion on food, entertainment, and community building. The series brings live performances and discussions with historians and journalists looking at LA and its legacy through the eyes of some of its many influential communities. Tonight, we will hear from Josh Kuhn and three of the scholars behind this series. They'll talk about LA, the objects that inspired both the musical interpretations and the conversations about our layered and fascinating city. Josh Kuhn is an author and editor of many books and anthologies, and the curator of numerous art, music, and public humanities projects. His research and practice focus on the arts, music, and the politics of cultural connection, with an emphasis on archives, global migration, and Los Angeles. He led a trilogy of Library Foundation Los Angeles projects based on the special collections of the Los Angeles Public Library that resulted in a series of books, exhibitions, and public programs. His writing has appeared in many publications, including the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and the New Yorker. Along with his many accomplishments, Kuhn won the MacArthur Fellowship in 2016. He'll be joined by Tyree Boyd Pates, who is an associate curator at the Autry Museum of the American West, where he oversees exhibitions that engage communities that have been omitted from American history in the West. Previously, Tyree was a curator of history at the California African American Museum and a professor of Africana Studies at California State University, Dominguez Hills. He served as an Annenberg Fellow and an Innovation Fellow and guest professor in 2020 to 21. In addition, he is a curator of numerous critically acclaimed exhibitions, such as No Justice, No Peace, LA 1992, How Sweet the Gospel, Gospel Music in Los Angeles, California Bound, Slavery on the New Frontier, 1848 to 1865, and Cross Colors, Black Fashion in the 21st Century. Suyapa Portillo is an associate professor of Chicano, Chicana, Latino, transnational studies at Pitzer College. Her research and teaching priorities include Central American history, migration to the US, gender and labor in Central America, LGBTTI Latina, Latino populations, and queer immigration, migration in the Americas. Her work focuses on the intersections between labor, gender, ethnicity, race, and other marginalized identities in workers' lives in Central America and the U.S. Last one of our guests this evening is Natalia Molina, who is a distinguished professor of American studies and ethnicity at the University of Southern California. Molina's work lies at the intersections of race, place, gender, culture, and citizenship. She is the author of two award-winning books, How Race is Made in America, Immigration, Citizenship, and the Historical Power of Racial Scripts and Fit to be Citizens, Public Health and Race in Los Angeles, 1879 to 1939. Her newest book is A Place at Narayet, how a Mexican restaurant nourished a community. Melina is also a MacArthur Fellow. She received the fellowship in 2020. Thank you all for being here. And please welcome Josh Kuhn, Tyree Boyd-Pates, Saryapa Portillo, and Natia Molina. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Jess, so much. Hi, everybody.
Hey.
We can unmute. We need some life. We need some voice. It's always fun to, you know, when people give introductions, and I in person, I never know where to look or like what to do. And everybody had a really good poker face, except for Tyree, who everything that was mentioned, he would make a different face, like recognition. It was great.
You can tell.
your resume becomes embodied. It's really great. I just want to start by just deeply thanking all three of you for being a part of Evoke LA and for being a part of this conversation tonight. I have learned so much from all three of you, both in the process of doing these episodes, but also just in engaging with your work for so long. It's just been a deep honor and privilege. So I just want to thank you all so much for being here. I also want to thank you for giving up your dinner hour. I was just sitting here as my hunger was kicking in. I was starting to think we should have had somebody recreate dishes from La Fonda, which we'll talk about in a moment, and have it all sent to you. That would have been great. We'll have to do it again. We'll have to have a redo. And I also wanted to thank you and to thank the audience who is joining us for being patient with our rescheduling and being willing to sign up again and to have this event again after we had to cancel the first time. As I think you all know, the reason we had to cancel the first time is that my mother passed away right like 2 days before we were supposed to do the event. I bring that up here because it actually produced something very surprising for me, which was that in preparing for her memorial, I was starting to, as one does, gather up photographs and mementos and things that evoke memory and trigger memory. And I thought, you know, just for fun, I'm going to go to the LAPL photo collection and I'm going to enter her name, her maiden name, into the photo collection and just see what happens. And sure enough, there were two photographs of her. I think we have one. There she is. Miss Camera Day, 1959. And it was just an extraordinary reminder to me about, which is so obvious, and I know all three of you know this, as well as I do, but suddenly it felt different, was that when we look at collections and archives, they are personal. They are personal and intimate, and they represent these singular lives and stories. So I guess I just want to also thank the LA Public Library for doing this work that allows all of our, many of our stories to live and kind of just be there waiting to be reanimated and interacted with. So sorry for the long preamble, but I just wanted to start there. But let's talk about you three. Enough about me. Let's talk about Evoke LA. And I wanted to maybe start just with, I hope the audience has been able to check out all three episodes. If not, you can stream them video on evokela.com. But I'm just wondering if you all might reflect a little bit or share your thoughts on what that experience was like of, the homework that everybody got was there was one piece of archival material from the library's collections that each historian and each musician would interact with. And we would then have a conversation based on this one item and then do the most natural thing, which is to sit together with cameras on us and talk about those things and make it feel live and organic. So I'm just curious what that process was like, or kind of maybe what you learned from it. I don't mean that in a top-down way. I've been just about the kind of historical and archival process of working with those materials. Natalia, do you want to maybe start?
Sure, I'd love to. Thanks. Thank you for giving us this opportunity, because just like you showed us that touching photo of your mom, I think this gave us a chance to bring our communities, you know, into the spotlight. And that was really fun for us, you know, whether we had a direct connection or not. In my case, I had a direct connection. La Fonda opened in the late 60s when my grandmother, Natalia Barraza, had her restaurant in the Nayarit and the Nayarit on Sunset. And, you know, the mariachis and customers would go to the Nayarit. People from the Nayarit went to La Fonda. And so to prepare for the episode, I took my family out to lunch, out to a restaurant. I had their homework. I made copies of all the menus for each of them. I put them in a manila folder. They're looking at it. They really came alive as they started thinking, as they started looking at the pictures, remembering each mariachi. And, you know, Nati Cano opened La Fonda because he wanted to give Mexicans a place where they could perform and they could be valued. He had been on tour in Lubbock, Texas, and was told after performance when he took the musicians out to eat that they could not eat there because they were Mexican. He said, I'll open my own place and everyone will be welcome. Chinese, Japanese, everyone will be welcome. So while he was looking at giving a literal stage to mariachis and highlighting them, he also envisioned the audience as a multiracial, multi-ethnic audience. And it was the kind of place where everyone was welcome. And then for, you know, my family, what they remembered was when they would walk in, that they would even start playing the Corrido de Nayarit, you know, kind of the theme song for the state of Nayarit. So we tend to think of, you know, Mexicans, Latinx as this monolith. But, you know, we also have to remember how important Patria Chica, you know, the small home country, was to them. So, you know, a lot of levels, learning about their, you know, my family's history, learning about regional identity, learning about Nati Cano, because that's the other thing. Even when restaurants, you know, even the La Fonda doesn't exist anymore, but even when we think about restaurants that have a long history, they don't always archive their own history. They don't always put it on the website. So this gave us a chance to have an example of what I call my book, an urban anchor, and the way that they bring in people from their own community, but also might be a really important space for other communities.
Maybe we could see that. We could see the menu that we were looking at for that episode. This is from the 80s. And there's Los Camperos, Nati Cano, exclusively at La Fonda. And Natalia, you also found a photograph of yourself on stage at La Fonda.
Yes, I did some archival work in my own family albums. And sure enough, there's a picture of me on stage at La Fonda crying. I probably didn't get the song that I wanted or something. And, you know, I think it's a documentation of the first time that I went up on stage at a club, but certainly not the last. That's what was interesting too. That's what's interesting too about La Fonda is, you know, entire families would go. I ended up also posting it on social media and just seeing if I would get any responses before the show, just to see, you know, maybe there was someone else to interview. One of the women from my high school, who's Japanese American, said that her family went, because that was also a place that, you know, for Japanese and Japanese Americans, when their family came through, when tourists came through, they would go to La Fonda. There were similarities, she explained to me, in food. And they would all, that Nati Cano and Los Camperos knew certain songs that resonated for the Japanese community, and they would play them for them. So, you know, they touched a lot of different communities.
That's amazing. Thank you. And then, of course, you'll get to see on the episode, if you haven't caught it, that all of these stories then come to life, you know, come alive with the mariachi, you know, Arcoiris on stage, which was really, really special. So that's great. Thank you. All right, Tyree, what about you? What about your experience interacting with a little bit of gospel music history?
Yeah. Well, again, thank you for this opportunity to be on this esteemed panel. Josh and I have been talking about gospel music for a long time, a few years, in fact, and I'm no stranger to the power of Black LA and the ways in which sacred music intersects with it. So when it came to the archival material of Doris Akers, and, you know, Josh summoning that, I found it to be what I find all archives to be, like portals, of, and not just for time and space, but really like for memory and in a way that evokes, sorry for the pun, but like evokes, evokes sensibilities that are like inherently cultural, but that are valuable to be shared. And so for Doris Akers, she epitomizes the ways in which gospel music had been gospel music as a genre was revolutionized in South Los Angeles and then like spreads and becomes commodified in gainful ways. And then when you see like a Chance the Rapper or a Kanye West or whomever sample Andre Crouch or George Cleveland or whomever, or have Aretha Franklin perform in the hood, like, you know, it means something. And so Doris Akers is just like a significant person who's contributed in gainful ways. And so for me, you know, I know intimately that for Black folks, particularly in LA, Black churches are our first museums. Like they are the places where we keep our most prized possessions, funerary materials, christenings, blessings, you know, all of these things get recorded first in the church and then they get disseminated. And also political mobilization happens. And so for Doris Akers and that material that you lifted and conveyed, just gives a glimpse, a brief glimpse into like a world that exists to this very moment, day and moment.
And the song that we're working with was a piece of sheet music from 1960, if I'm remembering correctly, Lord Don't Move That Mountain, that Doris Akers wrote with, you know, an unknown figure, Mahalia Jackson. And this is one of a number of Doris Akers songs that are in the library's collection. And we were fortunate enough for that episode to be joined by Maya Sykes, who I don't know, Tyree, what your reaction was, but you know, I'd heard Maya sing, but I hadn't been in conversation with Maya. And what was so, one of the most amazing things was, you know, you were there as the historian. And when Maya started talking about music clearly and about gospel and about Black LA, she was a historian. Like
she was a historian.
Everybody off the stage with the way that she approached history. What was it like for you to see that song be reinterpreted by her in that way?
I mean, it took me to Sunday morning at 11 a.m. But it also gave me a lecture like you would get in someone's class immediately. And that's the beauty, I think, that Maya and Doris and Mahalia and anyone who participates in Black Christian traditions, like we'll get every single Sunday when they go. And we gave everyone a little bit of church that day in that episode.
Indeed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Siapa, for your episode, we started with a photograph from 1986 that maybe we can see real quick, that was simply titled Central Americans, West 7th Street. It was a photograph by Stephen Gold that was part of LAPL's Shades of LA collection, very important archive. And I'm just wondering for you, what was it like when you first saw that photograph?
You know, thank you so much for inviting me. First of all, like bringing two Hondurans on stage, that's like impossible in the West Coast, right? So I was just so excited, you know, that you had two Hondurans, different generations, and Empress Self, right, there. And I think that was such an important moment because, you know, I'm often the only one or someone else is the only one that gets invited, right? We're not in New York or in Miami or New Orleans where you have a huge Honduran community. So that was really exciting for me. And I think also connecting to women, immigrant women and those of us that grew up with, you know, came here with our mothers and, you know, our fathers may have been somewhere else in another place. And you know, I saw myself walking down, actually my mom, we first lived on Westmoreland near Pico in Pico Union for like a month. And then we moved to Echo Park. So I kind of saw myself walking down, you know, Sunset Boulevard with my mom on a Saturday, doing errands or, you know, and it was so important. And I think I teared up a lot, you know, we were kind of far from the camera because there was just so many moments in that episode and you know, with the music of Empress Off and the conversation that came up that really reminds us that there's so much work to do to document not just Hondurans, but other Central Americans. And, you know, we have so much work to do to document these histories. And many people were, as we talked about, right, many people didn't want to tell their story because they were still afraid of persecution, you know. So I don't know, it's these newer generations, our students and our grad students, who are going to have to take on this project, you know.
And one of the
things, there may be no archives.
Exactly. Right. And we talked about that a little bit, you know, either there may be no archive, or what's in the archive might not tell the full story. And one of the things that we talked about was, again, the title of that quite powerful photograph, is Central Americans, West 7th Street. And we talked about how much work that title is doing there, with the notion that these are two Central Americans and not belonging to a specific country, the metadata suggests it's a mother and a daughter, but we don't actually know what's a mother and a daughter. It could be sisters, it could be friends, it could be whatever. And I'm just wondering if you could maybe reflect a little bit on that, I guess it's the politics of metadata, and about kind of how, you know, it's important that the photograph is there, it's important that the sheet music's there, that the restaurant menu's there, but without that editorial context, right, something also gets lost in its presence.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I just feel that there's this level of unknowing of, we just don't know what the Central American community might have been facing at the time. And, you know, unless you grew up in that period, in that time. But I do feel that even if there isn't enough information, it's sort of the historian's job to create some sort of narrative that can make sense for people. And, you know, in my own work with my book, Roots of Resistance, you know, I was documenting a strike in Honduras that there's really no archive for, because, you know, it was perceived to be a communist movement. And so, of course, everything was destroyed and, you know, during the Cold War period and stuff. So I would find these photographs, you know, and then I'd have to create a narrative by talking to other people about it. What do you think this photo's about? What do you think is going on here? Why are these people peeling bananas in this circle? And, you know, and some of the workers would say, oh, you know, those are the oficinistas, you know, the office workers who we forced in the strike to come down and help us peel bananas for our meal, you know. And so that's how I created that narrative by looking at it. So I feel that even though there wasn't a lot of description, you're right, they might not have been related. There might not have been, they might have been two random people just walking next to each other, you know, but that they were there for a particular reason in that particular time and space in that moment that really resonated with us.
So that point leads to something I wanted to ask all three of you, which is, you know, as historians, as scholars and curators and writers who work with historical collections of all kinds, how do we talk about that line between these materials as being kind of objects of documentary truth or documentary realism? And yet the work that all of us do when we do our projects does involve some storytelling, a lot of storytelling. And do you think about that relationship between, or I should say, do you worry about that relationship, about maybe that the stories that are being told move away from the nonfiction into, you know, the speculative? Has that come up in any of your work?
Go ahead and jump in.
Sure.
You know, so there's the both the problem that Suyapa describes in terms of there's no archive, and then there's a problem of when there is an archive, who created the archive? Who's mm-hmm. telling the story? From whose perspective is it? So for my first book, looking at Fit to Be Citizens, Public Health and Race, I wanted to tell the story of mothers and daughters, like we saw in that photograph. So the idea of it was thinking like, well, I'm looking at the early 20th century. We know there weren't a lot of Mexican immigrants who were women and children that immigrated, but if there were, where could I find them? And so I thought, what kinds of labor were women doing? What kinds of practices? And I thought, well, what about like birthing? What about like pregnancy? What about healthcare and the ways that these women might have bonded? And, you know, there just weren't those kind of records, and you couldn't do oral histories for that early period. But I thought, well, who is looking at these records? A lot of times it was health officials, city officials, social workers, teachers, immigration officials. And so you get those records, and then, you know, we're able to luckily think about, you know, what context is this happening? Would people have really willingly followed these rules that said, you know, you're uneducated, unhealthy, bad mothers? And so then you start reading the archives and you start, you know, using other people's ideas, theories that have worked in other contexts, you know, thinking about like reading it against the grain, right? Like, okay, this is what the story was, but why did they even have that law? There wouldn't have been a law against that unless people were actually doing it. Oh, there's these ideas of resistance going on, right? So there's that method. For immigration law, you know, we tend to look at, or for a lot of kind of timeline events, we look at the big events, like for immigration, what big acts pass, but we don't always look at what things didn't pass, but yet created a conversation. And we can look at that in our own time period, in terms of, you know, looking at immigration and looking at the way that, you know, Congress can't seem to pass any laws nowadays. And so even with that, even though they're not passing laws, there's a negative discourse around immigrants, right? Immigrants, refugees. So, you know, part of it is also seeing what's going on. And then for the book on A Place at the Nayarit, which is, you know, looking at my grandmother's restaurant, you know, like, so yep, I also did oral interviews. I had tried to do the archival method for that, but I didn't have enough materials to read it against the grain. And so like, so yep, I said, I'm like, I'm going to do these oral histories. And one day it struck me, I just had this image of my grandmother sitting on her, my grandmother's sister-in-law, who was like my grandmother, sitting on her porch, reading El Eco de Nayarit, this newspaper that was published in the state of Nayarit and was on Thursdays and was mailed to her. She had a subscription and she would read that. And everyone I knew read this paper, no matter how many decades they'd been in the US. And luckily I was able to track down a 20-year run of it at the Hemoteca Nacional library in Mexico, which houses these papers. And it's just this interesting example of, to learn about the lives of Mexican immigrants in Los Angeles, I had to trace it through this Mexican newspaper. So part of it is also just saying, like, what is important to this community and how can we look to those sites in order to tell their stories? Because the archive isn't either might not be there or might be incomplete.
And did your approach, Natalia, did it, maybe not change, but did it have a different inflection when many of the sources were directly linked to your family?
Yeah. I mean, yes and no, right? Because of course, those aren't always the stories they tell, because just because you do an oral interview doesn't always tell you the full story, right? So then I was like, yeah, but I see right here that you actually, you know, did this. Or, you know, doing oral interviews. There was, you know, the one that always stands out to me and that I talk about in the intro of the book, you know, about how even like we can't even think of oral interviews when people tell their own stories as telling this full story, right? I was at a Mexican restaurant with my mom and she introduced me to someone. She said, oh, that was the daughter. When she left, she said, that was the daughter of someone who used to work at the Nayarit, so-and-so. And I'm like, in my interviews, everyone said he was gay. She said, oh yes, he was. You just introduced me to his daughter and said he was married with like 5 kids. Oh yes. I mean, he was gay at work. He was different at home. That's just the way it was, right? So we also have this idea that we're more open-minded, progressive, liberal, whatever word you want to use. And, you know, decades ago or a couple generations ago, people were more conservative. But there was a lot that came out of those interviews and through the newspapers that things didn't always line up. And so it opened up very many interesting conversations.
Yeah, I'm sure. Thank you. A version of the same question, Tyree, to you, but I wanted to ask you specifically about what happens to these conversations around the stories that you want to tell from the documents when it's in an exhibition context. So right. As a curator, you make different kinds of choices because you've got limited wall space, you've got limited room, but you have access to the same amount of materials that a writer or a historian or a scholar might have. How do you think about the power that a curator has bringing these archival materials to the public and to life?
Yeah, I think about that responsibility almost every single day. And I think about the responsibility in being able to tell certain stories that Natalia were alluding to that may be uncomfortable, that even the community may not want to entirely embrace publicly. And there's a unique line to toe as a curator, historian, and scholar, but I take the approaches that Natalia illuminated, like using policy to highlight the ways in which the Black community, particularly in Los Angeles, felt about itself, or at least authority, and then using that as a litmus test to gauge the sentiment, and then conduct oral histories to fill in the gaps. Because given how Black culture is it's an oral tradition that our history is usually passed down as, a lot of what's isn't codified is actually the most valuable evidence. And so it's actually trusting a larger consensus and then allowing like the record or the log to substantiate those things. And sometimes it's even policy. And examples like Mayor Tom Bradley being such a valuable political figure in LA, but almost illuminates how like we would all feel in 2008 when Barack Obama won and Los Angeles serving as a precursor for that. So all that to say is like, as a curator, you know, it's a responsibility that definitely your community will remind you of if you get wrong. So your desire as a historian is to be as accurate as possible, even about some of the parts that could be uncomfortable too.
I'm guessing that's never happened to you.
Oh yeah, never happened. I have it all the time. That's what makes me a better curator and historian.
Are there any particular memories of a show that come to mind?
Oh yeah, none that I go on the record with, but I will tell you that the team that I worked on all those shows definitely were incredible and served as the best soundboards.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Siapa, when we filmed your episode of Evoke LA, one of the many things we talked about was, and I'm trying to find the right framing for it, but we talked about the kind of relationship between histories of Mexican Los Angeles and histories of Central American Los Angeles, and the gap or some of the tensions in terms of how present or not present Central American history has been in LA. I'm just wondering if you could share for folks who maybe aren't that familiar with that dynamic about kind of your take on where we are right now in terms of telling the histories of Central American Los Angeles.
I think we're in a great place right now. We're seeing the birth of Central American studies within ethnic studies, right? We're seeing, you know, because before, during the period of the wars in the 1980s and 70s, Central Americans were, you know, really talked about in the context of Latin American studies, in the context of war. And it almost seemed like that's the only way we could exist in history, right? Because of the civil wars and you know, people fleeing and Reagan and the Cold War, which are really important pieces of history. And actually, I wrote my book about the mid-50s because I wanted to predate what happens before those wars, right? Like, how does the Cold War start? And, you know, there was resistance to the Cold War in all of these countries, but particularly in Honduras, which is a country that's always seen as like the backyard of the United States in the context of the wars, right? The civil wars that happened in the 70s and 80s in El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Guatemala. But so it's a good time to be Central American. We have, you know, a critical mass of students in places like UCLA, and, you know, we have, you know, Cal State Northridge, Cal State LA, you know, Fullerton, like you're seeing the growth of sort of Central American thinking and, you know, what that looks like. But the history, so it's interesting because I'm an oral historian partly because, we are also, just like African Americans, Central Americans are an oral tradition, right? This tradition of testimonial is really important throughout history. And that's how, you know, histories are passed down as well in Central America. There wasn't formal education till the early 1900s, and women weren't necessarily educated. You know, my own mother only went to sixth grade. And if you talk to most people that have migrated, right, they haven't made it past third or fourth grade. So orality is really important in our community, both here in the United States, but also abroad in Central America. So what I was going to say about all of this is that gives us an opportunity to tell a particular story. And of course, we try to triangulate with archives and images and maps and histories, but that's becoming hard. It was really hard to do that in the 80s and in the early 90s because many were undocumented. Mm-hmm. And they were political people. So in my previous career, before being academic, I was a union organizer and a community organizer. And I remember meeting so many activists and, former leaders of the Guatemalan revolutionary, you know, movements and the Salvadoran revolutionary movements, working as janitors in LA, who told their story in secret, but not on the record. You know, they may have been using pseudonyms because, you know, they were undocumented. And, you know, so I have this view, you know. I mean, people even talk about who were captured by the military and who spoke, you know, who were tortured and what they said. I mean, these are all like the secrets, you know, in the Central American community that haven't been officially documented. And I don't know if they will be, like, you know, leftists who were trained during that period, right, in Marxist-Leninism period, you know, are trained to not share those stories, right? Right. That's part of the training. So they're going to go with them, you know, to yeah. the tomb. So it's a great moment for younger generations, younger than me, right? Because they really come with a fresh eye to these stories. And so I feel like if they were to interview this generation, there's more hope of more information coming up. Now, you were saying, you know, have people ever questioned you? Yes. So Central Americans get fact-checked and questioned a lot. It's a polarizing thing, you know? If for example, when the coup d'etat happened in Honduras, I was in a show by David, remember, was it Luengas, had a show in Telemundo that was really political and spicy, right? Like at 11 o'clock at night. And was it Telemundo or Univision? I can't remember. I think it was Telemundo. And he invited me to come, and he invited a right-wing Honduran. And we had this debate about whether or not what happened in Honduras in 2009, which was the kidnapping of the president and taking over, a coup or not, right? Because the Barack Obama administration was saying it's not a coup, you know, and we're saying, yes, it's a coup. Let us tell you why historically it was a coup. And so we're having this debate for, I don't know, whatever, 6 minutes, you know? And he said he got over 1,000 people emailing him, questioning whether or not it was Honduran. And the network wanted to know if I was Honduran. So I had to send a picture of my passport that says I'm Honduran, because, you know, how can this Honduran from a country that has been an ally to the United States be so political? You know, like, why is she saying this? Like, why attack Barack Obama, right, in this moment? So we're constantly fact-checked and critiqued because it's still polemical. We're still, even though technically the Cold War, quote unquote, is over, these sentiments of anti-communism, I mean, we saw this today, yeah. You know, in our news, right, are still alive and well there. So, I don't know if that kind of answers the question.
Yeah, thank you. So, you know, as we all know, through the work that, you know, all of us do, you know, when we work with archives and collections, we have to, in a way, rely on what's there, be they formal archives like the ones at LAPL, or informal archives that, you know, might be family archives, personal archives. And I'm curious, for each of you, when you look at kind of the state of LA history right now, what are the archives that you would love, or that you would love to see, or the archives that you wish existed that don't exist right now?
I'm going to jump in because I want to follow up on Suyapa's point.
Yeah.
So I'll approach the question a little bit differently, which is, it's not just the archive, it's the questions we bring to the archives, right? So, you know, many of us are trained in, you know, African-American studies, Latino studies, you know, we have our expertise. And especially, you know, in expert positions, whether we're professors or curators, you are the expert in your field, and we don't always do projects in other fields. So then we might not even touch those archives. Mm-hmm. And yet in those archives, you'll find, oh, it's, you know, South LA, it's, you know, which I'm gonna associate with African-American history, but actually it had this rich Latino history, and we need to bring that out. You know, and that's been brought out to some degree now.
Sure.
But you know, the book that I just finished, A Place at the Nayarit, it's a Mexican restaurant, and you think about it, you know, at that time period, mainly catering to Mexicans. And that's true to some degree, but that becomes a category that kind of obfuscates this rich Latino history as well. So there's a cross-ethnic, cross-racial community that comes there, but there's also diverse Latino groups. So unless you kind of ask that question, you don't know that. So, you know, Echo Park is home to a long history of Cuban refugees. There were less Central Americans that I found that went to the restaurant, some Colombians. But also because it's in the backyard of Dodger Stadium, all the Caribbean players that came through town went there. And there's also this rich way in which that overlaps with African-American history, right? Because many of them are dark skinned. So they also didn't want to go to other places, even though they were wealthy and famous. But they thought, you know, I'm not going to be discriminated against here, and I can speak in Spanish. So it's also the way that we need to read archives across each other, right? And, you know, I think the LA Public Library collections, it's a great example of that, the Shades of LA. So one way to do that is if you're doing like an ethnic history, not just to think about, you know, looking at ethnicity and race, but what about place? And when you look up certain places, and all of a sudden you're like, oh, a lot of people went through here. Really? How did they talk to each other? So along with that, you know, that mother and daughter that were there on 7th Street, what other, like, what if we look at the photos and like GPS map them, who else pops up around them when they turn the corner? Who did they see?
Yep. Absolutely. Thank you. Tyree, how about you? This question of what archives would you like to see, or what collections do you wish existed?
Sheesh. I think they all do exist. And they are still in people's basements and attics and hidden areas. But I'm like really interested in like Black queer LA history, mm-hmm. and like the pockets it's lived in, and then like finally giving it the proper platform that it deserves, whether it's a museum show or whatever. But like, I feel like it's deserved. And I think it might be, to be honest with y'all, I think I would love to like curate like a baller Vogue exhibition, because I feel like that history just needs, of course it's thriving, but it deserves like further amplification. And I would of course co-curate it with someone in that world, but I feel like that archival material deserves highlighting. So that's just my thought.
Well, hopefully this will spawn lots of people, right? sending you material.
Yeah, pitch me.
Yeah. So Yapa, how about you?
Yeah, I mean, I think I want to echo that. I think queer Central American, queer Mexican, African American, people of color, archives are critical. You know, at some point, I know that the Southern California Library has a great archive that needs to be worked as well, right? Like, I think queer lay, and you know, I'm one of the co-founders of the Mayday Trans Queer Contingent. It's no longer active, but you know, we worked for 10 years on trying to bring attention to queer migration issues in the city and among the immigrant rights movement. And so we were generating, and as we were doing the work and writing our memos and flyers and pictures, we wanted to archive stuff like that, you know, and people kept offering us space to put it somewhere, because we know it exists, it's out there, right? And you're right, in private archives. I also think the archive on Central Americans is out there. I don't think it's disappeared, or it's just, you know, for whatever reason, for state secret reasons, it's hidden right from us. But it will appear, right, at some point. And that's how I feel about queer Central Americans, queer African Americans, and that Mexican history, because we know it's there. And then the other part is I want to see sort of more, especially because I lived and worked in the 90s, right, in organizing both in unions and in the community. I want to see a different narrative be told that comes from the bottom up versus just from the institutions like the labor unions themselves, because so many immigrants, not just Central Americans, but Mexican immigrants that I worked with, Caribbean immigrants, challenged the unions and their leadership, because at the time, for instance, there were it was an all-white leadership leading, you know, union members who were trained leaders in their own country, who had careers, who knew how to do this work. And they saw there was so much contradiction there. So I'd love to see more of that kind of oral archive come up in the official, and when we talk about labor history and the making of the immigration rights movement in the 90s here. Not that it started in the 90s, but the 90s version of that movement.
Great. Thank you so much. We've got a handful of really good questions that have come in. So I thought maybe we'd open it up to audience questions. And I wanted to start, the first one is, and this is open to anybody, but Suyapa, I have a feeling you might want to chime in first. Do you know how much chronicling has been done on Costa Rican Los Angeles?
Yeah, very little. So there's very little. I think most work in Central American studies has happened around Salvadorans and Guatemalans, because those were the first sort of waves of migrations here. For example, so Costa Rica, there is a Costa Rican community. In fact, the best way to learn about it is to go to the Independence Day parade in September 15th or 16th in LA. But yeah, there hasn't been much. And I think what's interesting about Costa Rica is this, it presents a really interesting racial narrative, right? Between indigenous, Afro-Caribbean and mestizo communities that have migrated to the city. But I don't know of very much work done here. I would say maybe more in Miami or in maybe New York, other states.
Great, thank you. This is one that I think for all of you to chime in on. Did you have a target audience, in quotes, that you were trying to reach with any of your projects? And then were you surprised by the actual audience who your work resonated with? And did you find universal themes that many identified with? Open to anybody.
I'll throw it in, relating the gospel. So when curating that exhibition at CAM, How Sweet the Sound, Gospel Music in LA, we were curating the exhibition for those who, one, identified with the faith in particular, because for authenticity, and then two, those who grew up on the sound. But ironically, those who came to visit the exhibition were of all colors and creeds, but particularly religious affiliations. And I saw in one of the callbacks, or like the reflection areas, that even those who identified as agnostic or atheist found great joy in the exhibition, because the overall theme of the exhibition was joy and celebration, and just the inspiration that gospel music as a genre gives. And so that was cool when you hit both sides of the coin or the spectrum. It taught me a lot, both across racial lines and also religiously.
Awesome. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Natalia, do you have a thought on that question?
Yeah. So when I started the book, A Place at the Nayarit, it started off as a talk, a lecture I was invited to give. And I just finished my second book. So I was like, oh, I better come up with some new material. So to me, I was interested in doing the project at that point because Echo Park had already undergone so much gentrification. And this was about 8 years ago. And I thought, you know, I would come up to LA to visit my mom. I'd stay at her place in Echo Park. And then I'd go somewhere and people would say, oh, where are you staying? Echo Park. Oh, at an Airbnb. I'm like, no, no, people live here. Like, people have lived here for a long time. Oh, you must be so happy about the changes that you're seeing in Echo Park. I'm like, it's complicated. You know, yes, it's nice to have a cafe to go to, but if it edges out my aunt's grocery store in Bate, it's complicated. And so I wrote the book kind of to, I wrote that first lecture to talk about that, just to show like places have history. We need to document them. But what was interesting to me at the talk was that people came from all over, and a lot of people like from Boyle Heights, Highland Park, that were seeing their neighborhoods disappearing and really feeling this urgency to document them. So then when I went from writing like a lecture to a book, I wrote the book with those people in mind. So to me, the book is a bit of a how to document your own urban anchors, your own neighborhoods. And I really want to be able to teach that as well and use all the kind of digital tools that we're seeing that museums use, right? That we're seeing this new newsletter, how to make a neighborhood or making a neighborhood on the Virgil area, East Hollywood, that Gustavo Arellano just covered in the LA Times. You know, you don't have to write a book. You could do it through your Instagram exactly. stories, your Substack, your newsletter, your story maps. There are lots of ways to do it. And so I really want the book to be that, so that we can, you know, all it starts off with people documenting queer LA that way, Tyree and Siepa, and all of a sudden then you see it and then it grows. And before you know it, we have a very different version of LA as a place.
Absolutely. You know, last year or a year and a half ago, I was doing these kind of micro histories based on Ed Ruscha photographs on Sunset Boulevard of music venues, and was writing about, well, not about music venues specifically, but about the music that took place inside these buildings. And they were small little pieces, but every time I would research them and, you know, do my interviews and publish them. And then inevitably you'd get flooded with commentaries from people like, well, I was there and it actually wasn't that way. Or like, oh, you should talk to so-and-so. And suddenly an 800 word piece, you know, you realize, oh, there's an entire book here. And that every time you start telling one story, it then amplifies and produces this avalanche of other stories. And that's part of the challenge and the joy, I think we probably all agree, of doing this kind of work, is that it never ends. And now, Natalia, that your book is out, you know, I'm sure there's a bunch of stories that have happened that, you know, that you've heard that maybe you're like, oh, I need to do a new edition. It just came out. I think we have time for maybe one last question. No one's telling me to stop us, so I'll ask one more if that's cool with everybody. And we've touched on this maybe a little bit, but if you were to create an archive for your community today, what would you make sure to include?
I can go on this question. I think, so I grew up, well, part of my life in Echo Park, and then we migrated to Highland Park, where I've lived since I was, I don't know, 10, 12 years old. And as I see Highland Park changing drastically, you know, the Guatemalan Panaderia is not there anymore, and the Chinese restaurant's not on New York anymore. And my favorite Chinese Korean restaurant is gone from Figueroa Street. I wish I would have taken pictures, because, you know, these are the places my family, we would go for like graduations, birthdays. They weren't fancy restaurants, but they were like places we liked to eat at, and, you know, we could afford at the time. I wish there were more pictures of those moments. You know, we didn't have cell phones or easy ways to document that. More pictures, and then definitely this oral history of, you know, oral histories of the lady who cut my hair, whose business has been shut down because of high rent, you know, most of my life. She wasn't really trained as a beautician. She just cut hair in this corner in the wall. Like, those stories are really interesting to me, you know, that. And I, you know, as Natalia's mentioning, right, like, you know, who went where and how many friendships my mom started at these places, the local barbershop and the panaderia. And then the sadness, you know, my parents are in their 70s and 80s, the sadness they feel when they can't go to get a kind of bread that they enjoyed for so many years because, you know, it's out of business, right? And Elsa's is closed, you know? And so images, oral histories, stories would be great.
And then there's the kind of bittersweetness in some cases, Highland Park being a good example, downtown being a good example, and Natalia, your family's restaurant being a good example, where the signage or traces of the original signage remain on the buildings. That kind of, on the one hand, are really important in terms of presencing, but on the other, call attention, of course, to the loss, and there's a kind of haunting and ghosting, you know, that can happen at the same time. So I'm hoping that this conversation for, you know, all of you who are kind enough to join with us, not only kind of helps us all to keep our eyes open to historical collections and archives about Los Angeles, but to see the city itself in a way as this living archive where there are signs and traces and ghosts everywhere. And it's our job in a way, living here, to be conscious and pay attention to the history that is right in front of us every single day. So thank you all so much for being here. Thank you for being part of Evoke LA and for this conversation. Jess, I'll turn it back over to you.
I'm trying to get my, you can hear me. I'm like the voice of God. Anyway, I'm so moved by this conversation, and I'm just moved by the idea that these stories need to be collected, and that photographs exist. And thanks to Los Angeles, the public library, these archives are open for all of you out there to look and to see, and to hear all of you tell stories about your own families. It's been a beautiful project. It continues to be, and I'm very grateful for all the work that you continue to do and just this conversation this evening. And please go to evokela.com and listen. I mean, there's music, there are stories, there are these conversations that are really rich and beautiful, and they give us a sense of this amazing city that we live in, and just how varied and vast and unusual it is, and how many all types and stripes and people of all sorts live here and have lived here for years. And so thank you, and thank the audience, and please look at Evoke LA. And next week, in a couple of weeks, we have a program with Bruce Miller, who is the showrunner for The Handmaid's Tale. We're going to talk, he will be in conversation with Nicole Sperling of the New York Times, talking about women's issues on television and how what women, how The Handmaid's Tale has affected conversation around women's issues. So I hope you will join us. And thank you all, Natalia, Suyapa, Tyree, and Josh. Thank you all for being here this evening, and a good night. Thank you.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible by the Hearst Foundation, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the Los Angeles County Department of Arts and Culture, Errant Fox, City National Bank, the Los Angeles Public Library, and additional generous supporters of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. To support programs like this, become a member at lfla.org.